You are listening to the podcast edition of AFI On Screen, a program of the American Film Institute. Images, upcoming schedule, and additional podcast editions at AFI.com.
Abby, how much freedom do you give, in reference to the Breakfast Club, how much freedom do those actors have? And how did you stop certain things? Because they are young.
I give them a lot of freedom. I really do. We had a three-week rehearsal period there, and I won't do anything without less than 2 weeks. And I like to cast early so that I know who it is well in advance, and I can talk to them a lot, and we can work on the phone and stuff. Rehearsal is an opportunity for everybody to say anything that they have on their mind and to make changes in the script. First week is like script conference. We tear the script all apart. Something you're not comfortable with, or something you're actually more of, less of. And I think it's important for an actor to feel, you know, involved in that process. I mean, he is an important part of it, and I accept that. I mean, to me, the actor is the most important thing on the set. It really starts with the actor. I mean, you protect the script, you know, through pre-production, through production. The script and the actors are like, you know, sacred. And I give them a lot of freedom. I like their ideas. I like their input. You know, they're all. If you don't ask them for something, you're not going to get anything. And you know, it's very easy for me to say no. What I like to do in rehearsals is let them have, you know, say anything they want, challenge me, confront me, and then once we're shooting, we know pretty much what we want to do. And if something comes up, if somebody has an idea and they want to try it, it's really easy for me to say I don't think that's going to work. But I like the actor to be the final, to determine, ultimately what the character is going to be. And I'm like the Supreme Court, you know. I mean, I can come in and say, no, that isn't right. But I give them a lot of freedom. I think it's foolish not to ask your actors. Your actors, I've found, know more about those individual characters than I do. I mean, Judd Nelson would come in the morning with these incredible comments. He read the script every single night for 6 months. He just kept reading and reading. And he had a fix on that character that I couldn't get because I got to watch five of them. He's only got to watch the one. And, you know, I'm more concerned with, you get that character and how that character relates to the other characters is really my job. But I think freedom is real important for an actor. You know, they got to know that they can try anything and fail and not be chastised for it. You know, they've got to have the freedom to. I mean, theirs is a creative process as well, and I don't like restrictions being placed on me, and I don't like being told, being given ultimatums and, you know, shut up, I don't need your ideas, because that just constricts the process. And they are creative people, and I think they should have, you know, any rights that are afforded me. You know.
Working with child actors or young actors in particular is something that some people are warned against, that it's difficult to do, but you seem to be able to bring out the best in young actors. Do you have any other tips specifically for working with young people?
Well, I think young actors are actually, I've found it, are easier. Somebody like Molly or Michael they haven't learned a craft, they're just born with it. I mean, they had it, they're just naturally talented. There's no question about their talent. It isn't something that they can fake. It's just there, and they're just bursting with it. And they have an enthusiasm and a willingness to try things. And you get an older actor who has an image, or he has an image of himself, or he has a public image that he has to adhere to, and he says, no, I don't really want to do that. I don't think, I haven't been in the business 20 years to say that or to do that, a kid will try anything, I mean, Michael would do anything. In 16 Candles, he was very concerned about how he was going to look. He made these braces, and he was playing a relatively unattractive character. And he started to realize, as he was going through the process, how important that was to accurately portray that. And then that became his sole motivation, I want to be this guy. And he went in and said, no, you got to make the hair stand up more. And, he started building that character. Whereas I've got other people to say, well, no, don't touch the hair. People know me by this hair. I find them to be much more open to things and much better collaborators. They're not so. I don't know if you know, I mean, I don't have a tremendous amount of experience with adult leads anyway. But those five kids is an ensemble. I mean, they were, I cut 20 pages of Molly's character out of the first draft. You know, she signed the piece, she'd read it, and then the next draft she got, she had, you know, 20 pages gone. I took all kinds of stuff out of her. She's the only one that doesn't explain why she's in detention. And in fact, you hear it just at the front, which was something I didn't post. She had this great long speech that she gave about what she had done to get in there. And it's a wonderful piece of acting. I mean, I shot it, but I took it out, you know. And she had this whole big seduction scene. There's all these different scenes. And I said, it's going to make the piece better. And she said, okay, fine. Now, I don't know if others that I've worked with would be quite so charming about that, you know.
Yeah.
Was Dee Dee Allen on the set too?
No, Dee Dee came on a week into it, so she was behind from the start. She'd come down every now and then. We screened dailies at night, which was on Weird Science. I screened them at lunch, which is not, I wouldn't recommend that. It's just great to, I would sit with her and we'd run the dailies. We had long dailies every night. It was at least an hour because we shot a lot of film, and I shot whole takes. You know, I mean, I didn't do pickups. I mean, I just the big confrontation scene at the end was 200,000 feet of film. I shot five actors, four sizes, two masters, 20-minute scenes. You know, two full magazines on each size on each character. And I wouldn't interrupt them if they screwed up. We just keep going. They get their composure back and go. I just never cut. You know, and I mean if. We started every shot with a full magazine, because I'd end the scene and then I'd just sit there, and the actors would go, I'd just go. And then I'd force them to, you know, to think on their feet. And so we had long dailies, and after dailies, Dee Dee would have these, you know, we had these great discussions. I mean, it may be a day of you know, nothing except just, you know, one little piece of conversation. But it was, and we shot in continuity. So it was this process of, you know, her constantly challenging me, saying, you know, is that really what he would do? I'd say, well, of course that's what he really do. And an hour later I'd say, you know, I don't know why I did that, you know. So that process of, you know, viewing the film and discussing it at length every night. Then, you know, the last thing on my mind, you know, 10:30 at night, is what we'd said the day before. Then you go home, go to bed, you come back, and you start. And we started out shooting 5-day weeks, then we went to 6-day weeks, which was pretty hard on the crew because it was in one room, but it, you know, we never stopped, we never shut down. And, you know, Dee Dee, while she wasn't on the set, I saw her, you know, every night. I mean, we spent at least 2-3 hours every night, and that was something that was, you know, that is really remarkable about her, is that she, we didn't discuss cuts. I mean, the individual cuts, that's secondary. It's the character and the story. And in our case, there was not a lot of story, so it was really the character. And she would force me to pick takes. I'd want to fall asleep so bad. And I was like, oh, please, can I go to sleep? But I knew I couldn't, because when the reel ended, she'd say, okay, what take do you want? And I'd say, four. And she'd say, we only did three. You know, and it's like, sort of like having your mom there, you know? Yeah, she was, she never really, because she started late and we had so much film, she never really caught up completely. And then we were going to cut in Chicago, and then we got moved back to LA the last week of shooting. So we lost 3 or 4 weeks moving, which was terrible, because you got this momentum going and then you have to stop and, you know, pack up film and ship it back and all that stuff. But shooting continuity was great. Because you got to, you know, you could go back and look at everything up to that point, and then you could make adjustments in continuity, which was, you know, a wonderful thing. It was a lot easier than having to figure, you know, put it all together in your head and think what you've done and what you have yet to do.
What was the budget when the shooting schedule
was on? It was 34 days. It was actually, we started out 28 days. That's when you're sitting with with the studio production people. They say, I think you can do this. In the old days, we do this in 3 days. You know. But we're going to give you 28. And then I got it up to 32. And we started out. We rehearsed for 2.5 weeks, and it was on a Wednesday. We were rehearsing. I said, I think we're ready. Everybody said, yeah, I think we're ready. So we started shooting on Thursday, which was nice, because we went Thursday, Friday, and then had the weekend to really think about what we were doing. I've since, that's something I'm doing all the time now. And Judd got, toward the end of the first day of shooting, Judd was getting sick. And by the end of the day, he lost his voice. Just wonderful when you're shooting in continuity and you have a character. You know, shooting in one day, got a character as a cold for 3 minutes, you know. So we lost him on second day of shooting, and then we lost him on the third and fourth. So by the sixth day, I think we were 4 days behind, and the studio went, you know, they went nuts because they put it in the computer and they project me out to 180 days, $70 million. And, the first thing, you know, they say, and we were long, we were about 135-page script, but a lot of it was dialogue, and I said, you know, you can't count a page a minute, because some of this is screaming argument that's going to go, you know, page is going to go in 10 seconds, you know. And so we eventually went 2 days over, came in, I think, 50 or 90,000 under, I think. And there was a lot of above the line on it because the project had been started by A&M and was bought out. So there were a lot of, you know, above the line costs that had nothing to do with what's up on the screen. I think we were about 5-2 below the line, which included, you know, all of this 25% studio overhead and stage rental in LA when you're shooting. And, you know, I mean, there's all those extra costs you get. And then shooting. And we had standbys because we were shooting in Chicago. I had, you know, a DP standby, and sound standby, and all that stuff. So we were about 5, something like that, with overhead. It's taken me like years to, you know, read a budget. I don't know. I look at my salary and the number of days. You know.
At the end of the Breakfast Club, when the two couples have paired off, sort of, you seem to lose Michael Anthony Hall. Why didn't you give him a goodbye? You know, why didn't you get a chance?
Well, his goodbye was really it was in the letter, and it was in his, you know, the others in that group trusting him enough to let him represent them. I mean, I have 5 people, and I mean, everybody's got to get something, you know. And what's Michael going to get? Michael isn't ready. That character was not ready for girls. I mean, you could say she's going to be your girlfriend. Well, I don't know. I'm really not. You know, I'm not ready for this yet. You know, maybe, you know, this is the kind of guy that like will get going maybe sophomore year in college. You know, he's just, you know, the bus has left him and he's on his bike. You know, I mean, he's just not right there yet. So I think it would be. Gene Siskel wanted him to get Molly. I had this long conversation with him saying he should end up with Molly. I said, no, that's what you wish. You know, going back to you, you wish, you know. And, you know, because he said, well, I really identify with that character. I said, yeah, but it was actually pretty constructive.
In casting, you know, you got to find all these young characters. How long in advance did you do it? How involved were you in casting? How did you convince the studio to
It's tricky, you know. I mean, as I'm finding now, as I'm going out and like trying to find more and more of these kids, you know. Are you talking about Breakfast Club or 16 Candles? I had
casting both in advance, or did you?
No, I had Breakfast Club was cast. 3 of the 5 roles were cast. While I was doing 16 Candles. I wanted Michael and I wanted Molly. And I wanted Ally Sheedy because I'd seen Bad Boys. And she was so great in that movie. She's just fabulous in it. It was a pretty good movie. I really liked it. It got a little, you know, there's a few acts of violence that were like a little gratuitous, but it was a really good movie. I liked it very much. And I thought she was fabulous. And she played this character got like completely stripped of her dignity and maintained her dignity. It was something I just, And she'd come in to read on 16 Candles, and the role was too small, and I thought, no, she's too good to play a role this small. I'll wait, you know. And so she was doing Oxford Blue, it's called, in England, and I just called her at her hotel, and she'd been sent the script, and I said, do you want to play? And she said, fine. I said, okay, I'll see you in February. So I didn't even hear her read it until we were rehearsing. And Emilio came in to read for Judd's part. And I was having a real hard time with that role because I was looking for a guy that was bland. I mean, his character is a character whose, you know, motivation in life is to be like everybody else. You know, he has no real character of his own. And I was having a hard time finding someone who could play that, you know, and play the looks right, you know, I wanted somebody that could play that role, be in that movie, in part of that cast without ever opening his mouth. And I had Emilio. Emilio was reading off-camera stuff for somebody, and I was watching him. I wasn't watching the other person. And he did such a great job. I went over and I said, would you want to play Andy? You know? And he said, well, I really like to play Judd. And I said, but I think that you're like the only guy in the world to play Andy. So he agreed. And then Judd, I had a hard time with that one too, because I had to find someone who was a pretty reprehensible guy, who said some pretty cruel things and said them repeatedly for a long period of time and really doesn't get redeemed until the very end. And I needed someone who could, you know, I sort of based him on a guy that I knew in high school who was just a horrible guy, but you just like to hang around with him. It was like a privilege to hang around with him and get insulted, and you know, I mean, like you'd never leave your sister in the house with him alone, or any money out, you know, unprotected, but you wanted to be around him. And I didn't have much luck here. I went to New York. I'd heard about this guy that was doing something in Memphis or somewhere in Tennessee, something. I was doing Making the Grade, which I saw for the first time last week, which was very strange. And he was late. I was waiting around, and Michael was there. Michael was in Catholic school at the time, and he had his blue pants and his shirt and his tie, and sitting there waiting for this guy. And like the door, his office in MC, the door burst open. This guy came in, and his pants were all torn. They had the same boots he wore in the movie on. And he was just like a mess in his bag, and he threw the stuff down. He said, I've been up all night on a plane. And he just turned right to Michael and started doing Bender on him. He was bang, bang, slapping Michael. And was gone in 10 minutes. He finished the scene, got up, said, I see you later, I gotta catch a plane. I looked at Michael, and Michael was sort of, and I said, okay, I think that's the guy. Because I, you know, it was like, he was terrible. He just beat up Michael and the whole thing. And I said, but I'd like to see this guy again. You know? Michael said, yeah, I think he's a nice guy. You know? So, I have no idea what the question was.
Sure.
I'm a great mumbler. That's why they have these seats so close. Is that what you want to say?
Yes.
Oh.
How about 16 Candles, finding Molly, and I take it this was her first act of
these. No. She was in The Tempest, which I didn't see until after 16 Candles.
I loved In Tempest.
I'd moved to ICM as an agency, and Hildy Gottlieb, who was her agent, sent me this 8x10. And I'm sorry, I really talk into my hat. This sort of freckle-faced girl, you know, it looked like Becky from Huck Finn, you know, and it was Molly. I think it was before Tempest, you know, it was one step above those. You ever see those head sheets where the kids, you know, are like this, you know, they have like five pictures and they're holding a peanut butter thing and they look real goofy. It was like the one right after that, sort of the young teen photo. And I put it up on the bulletin board, and I have a word processor, and I have this bulletin board, and I put it up there, and I was writing 16 Candles, and I had seen a rough cut of Vacation, and I really liked Michael. I thought Michael was great, you know, and he stole a scene from Chevy Chase, which is like, you know, a major thing. And so I had Michael in mind when I was writing The Geek, and I had Molly in mind, this girl who I'd never met. I said, you know, she doesn't look like that. You know, looks like Norman Rockwell, you know. And I finished the script. I told Hildy that I'd like to meet this girl, so I met she and her mother at at the studio, and she's like this normal high school girl. She sort of sat like this, you know, and she's like a regular girl, you know, and I liked her a lot, and I said, okay, but it was my first one. I was going to double check everything and be overly cautious. So I read everybody in L.A., and I went to New York, and we read, and I came back, and I read Molly again, and no one was anywhere near Molly. And I said, okay, you know, this will be fine, and she was, you know, she turned out great. So, you know, I've done two with her, and I'm doing another one this summer with her.
Are you going to continue doing stories about teenagers?
Yeah, I am. I've got one that I'm going to produce this summer that I wrote the script for, which is another girl story, which, you know, the studios are a little reluctant. I think Ned Tannen's the only guy that is interested. You know, they all want boy movies. I mean, even when they do a girl movie, like this new one out, she has to be a boy, you know. So. Yes, I'm a girl, but...
What's the one you're doing this summer?
One starts in June. It's called Pretty in Pink, and that's Molly's in that one. It's something I wrote for. I wrote for her right after 16 Candles. When I wrapped 16 Candles, it was like... I felt like everybody that I ever knew or was related to died on the same day. I mean, when a movie wraps, it isn't like... It doesn't atrophy. You just, you know, you go in, and it's over. I went in the last day of dailies, and we were shooting in high school, and we were building... The sets were built in the gym. And there was a dance studio off the gym that served as a screening room. And I was shooting there the previous night. I went home, came in the morning, and it was all torn down. And banging, you know, and tearing it apart. And I'm like, God, you know, because I mean, if I had my way, I'd be like Howard Hughes, you know, I'd have the spruce. Howard, get rid of that plane, you know, you haven't flown it ever. I said, well, but I still want it, you know. I'm like that. I come in, and they're tearing it down. I go in and watch The Last Day of Dailies. And I just felt terrible. And I wanted to go right away again with everybody that I knew from the first one. It's like I wanted to go do the sequel right away. So I went home and wrote Pretty in Pink for Molly. And it's taken a while to get it going. I mean, female movies are not something that the town jumps up and down for, you know. So they have this theory that boys make the purchase decision. You know. Tell it to Maybelline, you know.
Yeah. I heard you write your scripts pretty fast. I mean, how fast does it take you to do these?
I do them. I like to do it. And this isn't something I invented. I guess it was right after Godfather had come out. There was an interview with Francis Coppola, and he said the most important thing to do is to get a fast draft, get the first draft done, so you see what you have. And I thought that was pretty good advice. And so when I started writing scripts, I did that. I wrote, you know, as quickly as I could. And which is not to say to sit down and just, you know, get pages, but I think about the idea, I talk about it, you know, I have like 5 years down the line all figured out, and it always changes, you know. I mean, I say, okay, I have a new one I'm doing in September, which is called Ferris Bueller's Day Off, and I was like 70 pages through another one, and this idea hit me, and I just sat down and did it, just bang. I had the strike on Monday. And I got the idea for this thing on Monday night, and I mentioned it to the studio on Tuesday, and it was in budget the following Tuesday. And it was just, you know, I mean, if you, you know, I just, it's like, you know, I just sit down, and I don't move, I don't get up until it's over, you know, go to the bathroom occasionally, eat something, and sleep a little bit, but I don't break my train of thought.
You have been listening to the podcast edition of AFI On Screen, a program of the American Film Institute. For upcoming schedules, archives, and other AFI on-screen podcasts, please visit afi.com.